Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo. Today's guest is author Nadine LeChaminade. Nadine, welcome to Between the Covers.
Hi.
Today we're talking about your book, The Gates of Eden, released in February 2019, that has been called a coming-of-age story, a harrowing account of immigration in the 19th century America, an exploration of religious faith and motivation, and a chilling and suspenseful depiction of conditions that can lead to the unspeakable in human behavior. Could you give us a summary of the book?
Yeah, the book is about a young woman named Josephine Bell, and she lives in Victorian England in Liverpool, and her family experiences a sudden fall from grace. They have a middle-class existence. Her father is a merchant. And they come into great poverty, and so they're destitute. And they hear the message of some Mormon missionaries. Mormons now, their church now is called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but they're usually known as Mormons. So the missionaries are promising a great land of abundance, a place where no one goes hungry, a place where blessings fall down like rain, you know, on the righteous. And they say that this can be had for a journey to the remote wilderness in Utah, in the Utah Territory. So Josephine and her mother embark on this epic journey, and they cross the ocean. And in Iowa City, she is given a little two-wheeled handcart. And this is a tiny little contraption. It's a little bit like a wheelbarrow. So she and her mother push and pull this little handcart over several sets of mountain ranges and over the rutted dirt roads, and finally arrive in Salt Lake City in 1856. And in the shuffle for a home and a security, she ends up quite shortly after her arrival as the child bride of a much older Mormon polygamist. He's almost four decades older than her. And so there's some tensions with the first wife. The society that she has arrived to is not exactly what was promised. There's famine raging, there's a drought. And the Mormon Reformation is quite fierce taking place right then. It's a two-year period where the Mormon prophet Brigham Young wanted to fire up the faithful, fire up his base, you might say, and make sure that he ferreted out sin and that his people became more faithful. So church elders went door to door, ferreting out sin, asking people about whether they lusted after their neighbor's wife, whether they took an irrigation water out of turn, whether they grumbled against the authorities. And tens of thousands of people were rebaptized. Josephine ends up in a very small settlement in the outlying areas down in southern Utah. And she also, at that time, it was a time of one of the most colorful and tragic times in the history of the American West. The federal government was sending soldiers on Utah to stamp out polygamy, and people in Utah were getting more and more fearful, more xenophobic, and quite nervous about the soldiers, about the outsiders coming in. And so the scene is set for tragedy, and that's what occurs.
There's a lot to unpack there. Thank you. The main character, as you mentioned, is Josephine Bell, and she's a teenage girl from Liverpool, and she and her mother travel to Utah to escape poverty. And as you said, Josephine and her family lived in middle-class Victorian comfort until the death of her father, and then the family plunges into poverty. Why did you choose that background for her, and how does it affect her character?
Oh, that's a great question. Each chapter begins with a letter from Josephine home to her sister in Liverpool. And I wanted the letters to be literate enough. I wanted her, you know, a lot of people did not have the opportunity to go to school. And so had she been born in destitution, she probably wouldn't have been able to read and write. And I needed her to be fairly articulate and be able to express herself through letters. So I made her, she did have some schooling before there, fall from grace financially.
And it did do her well because she ends up as a school teacher when she gets to the to the settlement. So Josephine's two brothers do not approve of her and her mother's plans, and her sister Megan stays behind to be married to a young man. How does Josephine's separation from her siblings affect her?
Her two brothers taunt and jeer. They've heard rumors about polygamy. They've heard rumors about the Mormon prophet. And so they give her a hard time, and she becomes quite estranged from her as she leaves. On the other hand, her sister, she dearly loves, and they have a real deep bond, and it breaks her heart to leave her sister. And so after she leaves, there's, as I said, a series of letters between the two that compare their experiences, although Josephine doesn't. She hides a lot in her letters.
Well, I think we can all relate to that, something that we decide to do when we're young, and then maybe it doesn't work out exactly how we thought, but we don't want to tell anybody because we don't want them to say, I told you so.
Yeah.
The letters are quite touching just because she says at the end of each one, I miss you, or don't forget me. Please tell my brothers that we're okay. And they're nice. Josephine and her mother become close to some of the other travelers that go along with them. Do you have a favorite character?
Yes, I do. Sister Pert Maisie. And she was born into poverty, but she has a deep wisdom. She's kind of a wise old soul. And when I first wrote her into the script, I just needed a comedy, you know, a character who had comedic interest. Because they were undergoing so much hardship, and I needed somebody to keep things light. But to my surprise, as an author, she evolved over the story and became a strong character who had a lot of wisdom, and I loved her character. I wanted to figure out who she was, so I looked at hundreds of photos of old pioneers to try to find her face, and I also... I studied British slang from the 1850s, really, really studied that. And I read Dickens and just tried to get an idea of how she might speak. And she has a lot of colorful language. And after I'd heard enough slang, I could start making it up. And so, you know, when you die, you're pushing up daisies. And anyway, she has a lot of great lines. I love this woman.
She was my favorite, too. She was a real firecracker.
Uh-huh.
The book was inspired by accounts of your great-great-grandmother who made a similar journey to Josephine's. How did you find out about your family history?
Oh, you know, Mormons are record keepers, so they keep histories. And she left a memoir, handwritten memoir of several pages, only a few pages. And then her granddaughter took down her story late in life. And so I just had a little bit, some backbone to go on. You know, my great-great-grandmother also was a poor English girl who was raised during the period of when the cities were industrializing and there was great poverty. And she pushed a handcart. She had a horrible experience coming across the country with her handcart. And she ended up as a child bride when she arrived. She said she was waiting on the street for somebody to ask her home. And just within a few months, this 15-year-old had married a 54-year-old as his second wife. So she from there, my character takes a different turn. I just wanted to really use some of the historical elements that occurred then, and I wanted to make sure that my character had a real, played a part in those historical events and that there was a lot of interaction. But yeah, I also read hundreds of pioneer journals just to get a sense of the times. And I walked part of the Mormon Pioneer Trail and visited 1850s cabins. And yeah, it was interesting to try to trace the story and the lines of her life.
And you're a writer, but this is your first novel. Was this kind of when you found the story, or was it like, Ooh, this is prime content for me to write something.
Yeah, I've always been interested in my family history and in the history of this people who were so persecuted in, you know, when the religion first started, they were driven from state to state to state. There was an extermination order for them in one state where people were to kill them on sight. And they belonged to this religion that was started by a young man of 14 who went into the woods and came back with visions of God. And he must have been so charismatic. In fact, he convinced one of my great-great-great-grandmother to marry him, even though she was already married to someone else. But so you have this colorful people with a tragic, interesting, amazing history and so much courage with among this people. So I wanted to write about their story, and I wanted to write with honesty, you know, revealing some of the underside of the Mormon history, but also to write with compassion, because I'm no longer Mormon, but this is kind of my tribe.
For those of you just tuning in, we're speaking today with author Nadine LaChemina about her new book, The Gates of Eden. I had never heard of the handcart pioneers before, so that part was really fascinating to me. And as you said, they use these hand carts to haul their belongings over 1,200 miles from Iowa City to Utah. And you said they were kind of like wheelbarrows. I was trying to kind of picture in my mind what they look like. I was picturing a rickshaw, but that might
Yeah. They're Brigham Young designed them, and they were only used for 3 years. The experiment was hard. It was hard on people, but he was trying to find a way to get tens of thousands of impoverished converts over to his religious kingdom out in the desert in Utah. And he designed them after street sweepers carts. And they were basically a little box, but a box big enough that could hold 500 pounds of supplies. And then on each side is a big wheel, and it has a crossbar, and you pull it from the front and you can push it from the back. I picked up a crossbar and pulled just a little bit. I found one in an original, and they are really heavy, really awkward and really heavy. And I cannot imagine someone pulling them up over a mountain range on a rutted road. It's just beyond me.
People were very dedicated when they felt like they had something to go for, I guess.
Yeah.
And you mentioned this when you were talking about the book. In the town where Josephine settles, there's a fear of federal soldiers rumored to be marching towards Utah to put an end to the practice of polygamy and their leaders' political power. It culminates in a tragedy known as the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Could you tell us a little about what happened?
Yeah, and it's a very complicated event. The Mormons had been hounded, persecuted, their barns had been burned, their wives violated, their children, husbands killed. And they came to Utah with a bit of a fear of outsiders. They also, and there was a large wagon party that was passing through Utah. Brigham Young had warned the pioneers not to sell anything to the wagon trains anymore. So this large party's coming through. They have a lot more money than these poor, poor Mormons down in southern Utah in this remote settlement. They have 800 head of cattle, and they're headed for the oasis where the Mormons grazed their skinny cows. And they've just been through a drought. They're very worried about losing the grazing grounds. And they, through some series of miscommunication and horrible leadership and an apostle that fired everybody up with xenophobia and violent rhetoric, it resulted in a massacre of the wagon train. There were 120 people, and the only ones that weren't killed were the small children. and more than 100 Mormon men were involved in the massacre. It was a brutal slaughter. It's something that, this is partly why I wanted to start writing this book, because my ancestors were down in that town. They settled all around this area. And you can imagine somebody coming home from war and having PTSD because they've killed someone. Well, this was a whole society, an entire society that was commanded by their religious leaders to go out and massacre, commit a mass murder. And I would imagine that the social PTSD was just enormous. Many of the men were haunted for life. They also took a vow on the killing field that they were never to talk about this again. It was as if it didn't happen. And so they couldn't talk about it with their religious leader. They couldn't talk about it with spouses. And there was kind of a breakdown. I read in one history that the settlement emptied out. I could not find that piece of history again, but my understanding is that the towns just emptied out, that people wanted to flee the scene of this horrific crime. And decades later, Mormons still couldn't talk about it. If you were from that area, you didn't talk about it. In the 90s, the church president erected a monument there, and the ancestors of the people who were murdered and the local Mormons came, and they embraced and they wept and remembered this wagon train.
As I was reading about that massacre and kind of doing some research and learning about it, kind of a scary thing, I could picture this happening today. This kind of thing, yeah. Just kind of stirring up this fear and this rhetoric, and then having people kind of panic and feel like, oh, we have to do something to protect our town. One thing I thought was interesting, I was surprised to learn that Utah was the 45th state admitted to the Union in 1896. And it sounded like that had a lot to do with some of their religious practices that the government didn't agree with.
Mm-hmm. Polygamy was a big sticking point, and they abandoned the practice in 1890s because the federal government put so much pressure on them. So yeah, there was a big brouhaha between the government and the Mormons. And it's interesting because after they abandoned the practice, there were a lot of Mormons who felt that their prophet had erred, had led them astray, and they continued to practice. And many went into hiding over the decade. Many went to prison for continuing to practice polygamy. And now there are tens of thousands of splinter groups, especially in southern Utah, Arizona, that still practice.
So on that same line, religion, specifically Mormonism, is a big part of the story. I read that you were raised in the Mormon faith, but later left the fold. What was your relationship with religion as a child?
Oh, you know, I was so devout. I just felt such a spiritual impulse and such a yearning for God. And I used to go off, you know, to the woods and pray by myself. And I think religion meant a great deal to me. Yeah.
How would you say your ideas about religion have evolved since then?
Yeah, well, some of the historical things bothered me when I found out about them when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and I felt more and more out of sync with the culture, even though I think there's much to admire about the Mormon culture. The people have a lot of integrity. They're good people. They're salt of the earth. But I did feel out of sync with some of the culture and some of the policies. So began a long evolution. And because religion had been such an incredibly important part of my life, I really wanted to find and something else, a place to land. And I visited many churches and read a lot and kind of had a long journey. I'm now an ordained Buddhist, and it's a there's no deity, and it's kind of the opposite of Mormons, but I feel very comfortable in the lack of a box, you know, just it's more for me, it's more of a spiritual practice than a worship of God. It's about practicing meditation, practicing mindfulness.
So everybody knows something about Mormons. What's something that they know that is wrong?
I think that right now there's kind of a tension between some of the leaders and a lot of the membership, and it's over gay rights issues. The Mormons have come out right on this issue. For a while, children who had parents who were married and gay could not join the church, and so they would go to school and they might be the only kids in their class who couldn't be baptized, and so there was a lot of exclusion. But my sense is that Mormons on the whole are more compassionate than that, that many of them have children who are gay or transgender, and or they know somebody or somebody at work. And I think that there's a great deal of sympathy and empathy and feeling like they would like to see the church nudge to a more embrace, more welcoming stance. And a lot of people have left because of this. But I don't know if it will ever happen. But I would hate for people to paint people from the Church of Latter-day Saints, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, their new name that they want you to use. I would hate to see them painted with a bad stripe, because so many are really good people.
Let's talk about immigration a little bit. Josephine and her mother come to Utah to escape poverty and hunger, and many others did the same. In what ways are the handcart pioneers similar to today's refugees?
Yeah, these are good questions. The question about violent rhetoric and how it results in tragedy often, and the question of immigration, why people immigrate. I think they've always immigrated for the same reasons. They see opportunity and they often leave poverty. And often it's not just poverty, it's survival. It's, you know, you see people leaving countries where their life is far, far worse than Victorian England, than an England that was industrializing, because people not only deal with poverty, but with violence. But it's the same urge we'll always have, immigrants, we'll always have people wanting to move around this earth because they are fleeing circumstances that make it difficult to survive. So, and I think that's why historical fiction is really useful. It can inform how we talk about things. And you can see that, you know, this has always been part of the human condition, and it probably always will be. These issues of immigration, religious xenophobia, violence towards others.
I did want to talk about that. Your book is thoroughly researched, and obviously you know a lot about the subject. And the book talks about some sensitive subjects such as polygamy, divorce, religious violence, and persecution. Have you received any criticism from readers or others for the way that you broach these topics?
It's interesting. People who are not LDS often think that it's quite a sympathetic portrayal of Mormons. They came away understanding them better, having a deeper sense of who they were, and having an appreciation for their history and for their courage to launch out across half a world to go to a remote wilderness and make a life for themselves. So they feel that it's quite sympathetic. Some Mormons feel that it's not sympathetic, and I think they're uncomfortable with talk about the Mountain Meadows massacre, some of the violence that occurred. Brigham Young, this was one of the reasons why my testimony of the church, my faith, was first shaken. I came across some of his sermons when I was about 19, and they shocked me. They were there was so much violent rhetoric and so much racism and misogyny. And I mean, he was a genius. He was an organizational genius. He was a colorful, folksy, charming man. And he also had, he would do whatever it took to get his way or to shape his people, you know.
I did wonder, when I was reading this, how they kind of had the money to bring these people from all over the world, you know, put them on ships and take them on this train. And then they built these hand carts and then brought these people to their society that they'd built. And I was thinking, how did they get the funding for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. They actually, this was the very cheapest way you could go. You load 500 Mormons on a ship that you, I think they hired the ship owners to take a whole shipload of converts over. And the hand carts did not cost a lot. All of them were handmade. And in general, wherever the early Mormons settled, they had a lot of industry and they ended up doing well for themselves. They, I think that through their industry, they were able to raise money. And this was the very cheapest way that you could get tens of thousands of people have it across half the world.
You have a website at NadineLeCheminant.com. It has many images, both photographs and paintings of the era you describe in the book. So it's really interesting. Are there other ways readers can discover more about you and your work?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, on my website, it's www.NadineLeCheminant.com. And I know that nobody got that. But you can also just Google the Gates of Eden and Nadine, and it should get you to my website. There is a lot of information there. There are stories about my ancestors that weren't in the book, and like you said, a lot of archival images. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
and book club discussion questions
too. Yeah,
I appreciate you talking to me. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners about your book, The Gates of Eden?
Yes, it is a coming of age story. It's about a young girl on the cusp of becoming a woman. And so she goes through all of these emotions. You know, she's battling faith and doubt and love and fear, and she falls in love. And she, you know, she's having all of these experiences that a young girl has. So it's very much a coming of age story, but it's also not exactly a story for children or teenagers. It's got some adult elements, and it's got a little bit of a harder edge to it, you might say. So the historical events in this 3-year period were pretty colorful and tragic, and I wanted to include that historical context. So it is a coming of age story, but not a typical one. But I think readers will enjoy it.
Nadine LeCheminant, thank you so much for talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Thank you, Bethany. I appreciate your interest, and it was great to be here.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.